I realized that word travels quickly between sections. So y'all might have a, oh, the smiles are already coming, a premonition of what's coming next. Because this originally, honestly, started out more of as a way to give you all a little bit of a break, because transferitis is a very serious and communicable disease that you all seem to be very subject to right now. As you all have probably already heard me whine about before, we instructors get our own form of springitis. We all become a little bit grouchier, maybe, than even we normally are. I'm going to be beyond snowed under this week, it looks like. And so now it's become for my own benefit that I wanted to see what your initial response would be to the idea of the exam being next week instead of this week. I take it by these smiling faces that you appreciate the proposal and might be willing to accept it. So it would be Tuesday of next week. Now, for those of you who object to it, but just don't want to be the one person that gets beat up by everybody else, you could, in theory, still take the exam on Friday. But if you were going to do so, please give me enough warning that I would actually write the exam by Friday. Or if you're just worried about the studying, you know, do your marathon 72-hour double all-nighter now so you can enjoy your weekend and then come back on Tuesday after you recovered and ready to take the exam, instead of having your weekend waking up in a blur Monday morning going, crap, there's OCHEM I have to deal with now, and then having a miserable rest of your weekend. You know, just keep studying the same way you were going to for Friday anyways. Just gives you a couple of days for it to settle in your brain. Part of the reason for doing this is yesterday I got scared. I came in the lab and thought, I forgot to write a quiz. Crap. Because they all came in with their papers, just like you all do when there's a quiz that day. It's like, I don't care about the lab lecture, I'll listen to it later. They were doing that. I was like, did I forget to write a quiz? I really got panicked for a moment. No, it's this, they had gotten around to reading the Fischer stereochemistry proof, and they all were worried about it because they realized, you know, once they got it, it's understandable and interesting and eventually simple, but it takes a while to get yourself there. So, in fact, that's what we're going to do in lecture today, is review that, and then Thursday will be our last chance for it to discuss that. We will be beginning some new material before the exam that won't be on the exam. Because since I have moved us ahead a bit by doing some of this carbohydrate in lecture, we're going to be able to tackle amino acids a little bit more properly than I've ever had the chance to, because I've got the time to. Especially with all this acid-base review that I had warned is going to be coming. So we'll begin that, but nothing outside of carbohydrates and amines will be on the exam. So just to give you the illusion of democracy, how many of you would like to have the exam on Tuesday instead of Friday? I won't ask who is opposed, again, just so that you don't get discussed with by your classmates. But again, if you do have some strenuous concern about changing the day, come talk to me during lab or office hours or something like that. So on to the lab lecture. This is going to be the one lab lecture that is for fun, because this is going to be a set of topics that you probably won't see again in organic chemistry, and possibly not ever again unless you do take a more advanced chemistry class. Some of this is theory that maybe I should have done before now. We're going to get a little bit into a discussion about modes of vibration, something we should have discussed when we hit IR. I was just so worried about NMR back then. But we are going to get to the point of what's going on with luminol. So that's the point of the explanation, but since it's so far into physics and spectroscopy, it's not something that's going to show up on a lab quiz. Now, if this was section two from yesterday, as I turned around, half the class started to act like they're going to get up and leave because it's not going to be on the lab quiz. I'm hoping that you have the interest to stay and you actually do get to make your luminol glow today. So there is the fun part that's coming, which if most people did get their luminol to glow yesterday, so they were happy. And so there's a couple other classes running. So when we get to that point, if you could run, show them the glow, that so they you can entice them and say, look, if you suffer through this many quarters of chemistry, you get to have 5 minutes of fun. Woohoo! We are going to begin our discussion of luminol today with what might seem a somewhat unusual topic, this thing known as the harmonic oscillator. So for those of you who haven't had physics before, this is a very classic example of a system that has what is known as periodic motion, something where the motion happens in the same way repetitively. So in this example, we have some kind of surface that is frictionless, that has no kind of resistance in the movement of this object that's resting on it, so no wind resistance or anything like that. We have a wall that there's a spring attached to, and that spring is in turn attached to this mass that's free to oscillate back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. And so as you can see, I've marked on this diagram the rest position of this mass where it would be no energy in the spring, and then we can imagine if this is displaced by some distance x. Now, the interesting thing about this example, or the reason this comes up, is what causes that periodic motion, which is exactly this relationship between the position of the spring and the force. So force is how hard the spring is tugging back on us, and we can see that there's two variables that will influence that force. One is how far the string is pulled, and notice that this is a linear relationship. So in other words, is how hard you pull on the spring is how hard the spring is pulling back. That's why we have a negative sign, because this is a restorative force. There's also this fudge factor that we put in there in order to make the force and the position proportional to each other, and that's called the spring constant, which is going to depend on the size of the spring, what it's made of. For the non-physics people, the main thing here is that the force is proportional to distance. Now, switching over into more mathematical mode, we can remember that force is mass times acceleration. Which, again, for the non-physics people, remember that acceleration is the change in velocity versus time. And velocity itself is the change in position versus time. So this might not be the exact right way to represent this. But we can imagine some kind of double delta. And I don't know if that's allowed as a mathematical statement, but the idea is the change in the change of the position is acceleration. The reason I'm showing you this is that if you don't know calculus, I can at least explain what I'm doing in this next step, which is to rewrite what acceleration is and rewrite it in terms of position. If we're talking about an object that can move arbitrarily, though, that's why we have to switch to calculus. And so those of you who do know calculus know that acceleration can be represented as the second derivative of time, second derivative of position with respect to time. Which then brings up an interesting situation, because we have an equation in which a function has to be linearly proportional to the second derivative of itself, which there's not an infinite number of functions that can satisfy this condition. One of the functions that does satisfy it, or one type of function, are the set of imaginary exponentials. So those of you in 1C or maybe 1D it is, you might be talking about polynomial expansions. And so you might therefore know that this equation is actually related to periodic functions. This is a more complex example. Even simpler example for something physical like a spring, we could just say a sine function. So just for, again, those who have had the math, realize that we have e to the ix, the double derivative of that would be I squared e to the ix. I squared is negative, and so that gives us the negative in this equation. And then same thing with sine and cosine. double derivative of sine is negative sine, double derivative of cosine is negative cosine. So these functions, cross that one off, these functions satisfy this equation, which is, therefore, how we can describe that spring moving back and forth like it was on some sort of sine wave. And so that's the harmonic oscillator. The harmonic part of it is the idea that it's moving back and forth with this regular motion. So just as we can imagine a spring moving back and forth, or it's a little bit more complicated than that, but we can somewhat imagine a pendulum swinging back and forth. What if we have two atoms that have a bond that connects them, and if that bond has some kind of stretch to it, what if we can apply the same system to two atoms vibrating back and forth? And that is the model that we use. The harmonic oscillator reasonably describes the motion of two atoms in a bond. But it turns out then that not just one type of motion is possible for a system. Because depending on how much energy there is there, depending on how far in the spring example you pull that spring, well, you're going to put more and more energy in that spring, which means that the vibration is going to be larger and larger in terms of distance. So in theory, if we had just the simple spring example, we could have any energy level we wanted to, up to a certain point, because if you stretch a spring too hard, eventually that spring deforms. It only has a certain limit to which that spring can act linearly with respect to force. Same thing in a bond situation. You stretch a bond far enough, it breaks. So there's at some point where this harmonic oscillator breaks down a bit. There's an asymmetry that gets introduced to it. But principally then, we could treat the bond the same way as having all these different energy states possible. With the caveat, though, that we're dealing with atoms, something that's a quantum mechanical system, which means you can't just have any random energy value you want to. You can only have very specific values. So you might remember back in 12A, we talked about standing waves and the idea that there's quantization of energy. The same thing happens with a bond. So excuse me. So a curve that represents the possible vibrational energy levels of a bond looks something like this. And you might notice some similarity to the energy levels of an atom. And we're going to be making a lot of parallels between these vibrational energy levels and electronic energy levels, which is what we'll be coming to later. I know I didn't give you a proper tell them what you're going to tell them and tell them what you told outline for this lecture, because I want to actually kind of lead us from one topic to another. But we're working with vibrational energy levels, which you might not have ever heard about before. I am going to be moving into the electronic levels, because that's how light gets emitted, moving between different electronic states. But what we're going to see is the two, the vibrational and the electronic, can interact with each other, which is how we get some of these unusual effects. So back to this story, you notice that the energy levels start out more spaced at the lower energies and then become closer and closer and closer together as you go higher in energy, again, paralleling atomic structure. The X here could represent distance, so if we have some middle point there where it's at rest, then we have a relationship to X squared, so we have sort of a parabolic curve. Then the main thing besides the fact that there's the shape to that curve is, again, that there's only specific energy levels. Since energy at the atomic level is quantized,
which it means it only comes in discrete packets. There are only specific energy levels, specific vibrational energy levels available to a bond. Now, since we're talking about vibrational energy levels, let me mention that if we have more than two atoms, then there are what are known as modes of vibration possible. So imagine we have a three-atom system, which, when I first did this example in section one, these circles were meant to represent balls, in other words, just to represent a random atom. We could view this as three oxygens as we want, if we wanted to. It's not meant to be specifically oxygen. What I want to show, though, is that there's several modes of motion possible. Imagine, for example, that in this three-atom system, the two side atoms act sort of as wings, and you have a scissoring effect, is that the pair of bonds is opening and closing relative to each other. We could also have stretching occur in which both atoms are moving in the same direction from the central atom. So we could say that is a symmetric stretch. We could have another mode of vibration where maybe one atom is moving in the opposite direction of the other relative to the central atom. So it would be an asymmetric stretch. And there are several other modes possible. I'm just showing you a selection so that you have seen this idea that there are modes of vibration. You've seen the results of this before every time you've looked at an IR spectrum. Because in a given set of atoms, energy is quantized. It's quantized into certain modes of vibration. Some of those modes of vibration end up not producing any signal because the motion has to cause some ability to interact with light. And in more advanced spectroscopy, we find out that there are actually forms of motion that do not cause an interaction with light, which means we can't see them. But that's why you get all those different peaks in an IR spectrum, because in the molecules we've had multiple atoms, some multiple modes of vibration. What we haven't seen is these individual vibrational energy levels, at least not clearly. There may be, in fact, instances where we can see some of that with particular functional groups if we knew where to look. But if we had the equipment to do so, if we had a gas chamber filled with hydrochloric acid, for example, that's only two atoms vibrating, we could see all these individual vibrational energy levels. On top of rotational energy levels. So, in that example I just gave you with hydrochloric acid, imagine that you had the central axis of the molecule that the molecule was spinning around. Well, because it's an atomic system, the angular momentum of the system, the amount of motion that you have in a circle, can only adopt very specific values. Again, meaning that the molecule itself, in terms of its rotation, can only have energies of very specific values. And these are the rotational energy levels. Now, the vibrational energy levels, since those can involve more motion, more atoms, they tend to have higher gaps in their spacing. The rotational energy levels tend to be much narrower in their gaps. So if you had a really sensitive iron machine, which we do have, but if you had the ability, again, to do a gas-phased spectroscopy of HCl, we would see a series of lines that would represent the vibrational levels, and then we'd see this fine structure, these little tiny clumps of lines, not light splitting in NMR, not the same physical reason, but maybe the same appearance a bit. And those would be the rotational levels splitting the different vibrational levels. So far today, all we've talked about is what nuclei are doing relative to each other. And I know you don't know the context, and again, we might not discuss this again, but for what we discussed so far, are there any questions? Well, now let's switch then to the electronic system, because light, when it's absorbed or released, is due again to transitioning between different electronic states. And we've talked about this somewhat before, electronic states, particularly back when we were talking about frontier orbital chemistry, when we were talking about homo-lumo interactions. So you might remember that in some unspecified system, that when the electrons are in the lowest possible energy configuration, that is something that is known as the ground state. When light interacts with the system, there are multiple excitations possible, depending on the size of the packet of energy in that photon. If we gave it the smallest possible packet of energy and just bumped one electron up one level, this gets us to the first excited state. Now, last quarter, I didn't get into it all, what goes on with the spin of the electron as it transitions from one state to another. So there's a couple of apparently random kind of technical details I need to give you about these spin states. So first is this. In what might be a misnomer, in classical quantum mechanics, there's a problem that arises when electrons change their trajectories, change their pathways. And when I say classical quantum mechanics, what I mean is the fact that what we look back at that as when we look back now and say, oh, here's this thing, quantum mechanics, it didn't all get invented overnight. It wasn't like everybody woke up the next day, blogged to each other, is this what quantum mechanics is? Oh, yeah. Things like the Pauli exclusion principle, in fact, were things that were settled after much of the rest of quantum mechanical formulation had already occurred. There was actually some way to resolve some of the mathematical or physical observations that they had made. So, imagine this. You have an electron that might be in one energy level, in one orbital. That orbital has a certain function associated with it. If you have the same electron in a different energy level, it's in a different orbital with a different mathematical equation. And part of the difficulty with quantum mechanics was, well, how can something be here and in one instant suddenly be here in a different equation? Now, I don't know how that got resolved, but I do know that those transitions only occur if there is some kind of correspondence between the wave function you start with and the wave function you end up with. So certain types of transitions electronically are just not physically allowed. And so, most of these transitions, the deal breaker is what happens with electron spin. So, when an electron goes from one energy level to another in this kind of situation, it has to maintain its spin during that transition. That's what is known as a spin allowed transition. If we were to instead flip that spin around to make it where it's no longer parallel with the first spin, that in theory, cannot happen simultaneously with its excitation. That's what is known as a spin-forbidden transition. Why? I wish I could explain. And maybe one of these days, I'll take quantum mechanics again to be able to understand it. Since you already know a bit of my interest in quantum mechanics, let me say that all of this I'm able to spout out is the result of me getting a C in quantum mechanics. It is one of only two C's that I got as an undergrad student. And look where I ended up. The other one was in physics. So it's kind of interesting that we're having a lecture that combines both physics and quantum mechanics. I guess this is me trying to make up for myself. But the quantum mechanics course, in my defense, was a graduate level course that was supposed to have all these math prerequisites that I didn't have, but they let me take it anyways. So if I remember this much of it, and that's how much I'm spouting out at you, when I get to some point where I say, I just don't know, well, I'm not a quantum physicist, but we'd like to learn more. To summarize then, the whole point is there are what are known as selection rules that say the spin can do this on this kind of transition, but can't do it in this kind. And for this situation, again, when you have an excitation between energy levels, the spin has to be maintained. So again, the normal case, an easy transition, is one in which the spin's maintained. That's called a spin-allowed transition. There's then a situation, as I was describing, where you could have the spin flip. And if you have that spin flip, it is known as a spin forbidden transition. Since it is technically not possible. Now, we're going to come back to that word technically in just a moment. But I need to give you some terminology related to these two cases that I just showed you. So, this used to really confuse the crap out of me, and I finally sort of figured this part out. When you have two individual spins, they act as individual spins. They have their own states, their quantum mechanical states. So each spin on its own can be spin up or spin down. When you combine two spins together, their spins interact to give you a total angular momentum. In quantum mechanics, once you have two spins that are acting together, they can form spin states that do not necessarily look like the individual spin states. In other words, individually, electrons might be spin up or spin down. When combined together and acting together, they may be at some kind of odd spin angle that is allowed because their total spin adds up to some specific value. So when you have two individual spins, they come together and ends up causing four new spin states. One of those spin states corresponds to having zero total angular momentum, total spin. And if you notice the top case there, where one electron is opposite the other, well, one is spin 1/2, the other is spin negative 1/2, they add up to zero. So this has a total spin equal to zero. Here's another one of those sidetracks that looks like we're getting lost on, but that's just how complicated and new this topic is. Think back to another case where we've had this term angular momentum show up. And I know this gets frustrating to non-physics people because you kind of get it, but maybe don't, but you do. If you think what angular momentum is, it's just the tendency for an object to spin to want to keep on spinning. Maybe I just got a new idea for a demo. Hula hoops. But no, it's the perfect example of orbital angular momentum. Because what's orbital angular momentum? The idea that an electron, even though it has its own individual spin, in its orbital, that whole orbital is acting like it's transiting around the nucleus. Where does this show up? Well, in atomic structure, that orbital angular momentum determines the shape of an atomic orbital. So recall the four quantum numbers, N, L, M sub L, N sub S. N is the principal quantum number that tells you the total amount of energy that you've got to play with, but L tells you how is that energy distributed, at least in terms of its rotational motion. So when L is zero, we have an S orbital. How many different kinds of S orbitals are there in one energy level? Only one of them, right? If L equals one, what kind of orbital is that? It's a p orbital. How many different types of p orbitals are there in one energy level? Three. How many d orbitals? Five. How many f orbitals? Seven. So in other words, L, which is this orbital angular quantum number, if we take 2L plus 1, we get the number of orbitals that are of the same type. That same 2L plus 1 shows up in this case as well. Because if you have a total spin of 0, it turns out there's only one state that has that spin of 0. Because we have this equation for spin multiplicity. Where S is the total spin. S is zero in this case. For crazy physical reasons I have no chance to be able to describe, it's the same situation as L equals zero for atomic orbitals. There's only one way for that energy to somehow be distributed. Well, what do we have in this other case? The total spin here is equal to one. And it turns out there are three ways to distribute that one packet of energy that are not necessarily the electrons individually being pointed up and down. That's the part that used to confuse me. Like I could see in this diagram I drew that I have two electrons that are both pointed up. You could say, okay, that totals a one. Then you have another case where both electrons are pointed down. You say, okay, that can, when you take the absolute sign, add up to one. But then how do you get the third case? And with this diagram, you can't get it. It is not just as simple as the electrons being up or down because they're acting together. But there are three cases possible. That's why up top here, that this kind of electronic state is called a singlet. We're down bottom here. This is called a triplet. Which often will use capital letter S and capital letter T to represent those states. So the starting point in both of these examples is the lowest energy level possible. So you could say S0, ground state. So then we have the first excited singlet state, and the first excited triplet state. Now, if you're wondering where the heck are we going, we're very close to getting to things glow. It's just one more step, really. Which, let's start to get into that. I'm going to just keep on going because I am taking more time because of the technical issues that I did in the other lab, and I want to make sure your stuff glows. So if you forgive me not entertaining questions on this part, press on. So, here is the situation. Anybody else hear that vibration? Something's going on with the HVAC again. It's not quite drawn correctly, maybe, but this represents... Well, I'm going to put X here, but realize we could be talking about a way more complicated system, but let's just pretend it's two atoms vibrating, so at least we could have the discussion. But here would be a ground state, singlet state, and then the first excited singlet state. By the transition rules, you're allowed to have an electron excited from one state to another. Notice, though, that unlike what we had talked about in the past, of simply an electron going from one energy level to another, we're stacking on top of that now the idea that there are different vibrational modes in each one of those electronic states possible. Which means the exact energy of absorption between two different electronic states can actually change a little bit, which is why you don't necessarily have an absorption in these kinds of situations at only one exact frequency, because we do have different vibrational levels possible. Once you excite up to the excited state, some of that energy might be dissipated as heat, going from one higher vibrational level down to a lower vibrational level. When light is released again, it might be a lower energy photon, which lower energy corresponds to lower frequency of the wave, which corresponds to redder light, so more towards the red than the purple if this is visible light. Now, I found out both that I am getting older and culturally irrelevant, I guess. Because I'm going to ask a question that's going to make some of you just smile, and you'll know why in a minute. How many of you know what a black light poster is? A black light poster. Right. Now, if you're someone even of my generation, which, no, I wasn't even alive in the 60s, but even as kids, we had this idea that the 60s happened. So you saw blacklight posters everywhere, which you see them in one of two places these days. Little kids' room, because they're all neon-y and glowy, or in certain shops that you would see up at Berkeley, that the poor parents that come to bring their kids every year to Berkeley to show, oh, this is Berkeley, and they're all these nice and shiny students, and they take them to Telegraph Avenue, and then they see what Berkeley's really like, and you see all these poor parents in just this total abject horror, because they didn't know what they were doing when they sent their kids to Berkeley. Those kinds of shops. If you still have no idea what I'm talking about, and any of you ever been to Small World and Disneyland or one of these other places where you're in a ride and you look down, you realize that whatever clothing you're wearing is white, is blowing a whole bunch like purple? Green? No, this is green. Or purple, the light would look like. What about these lamps over here, these UV lamps that we use to make the... TLC plates glow. Do we remember that at least? That, in colloquial terms, is called a black light. No, there's no such thing as black light, but it's really UV light, which we can't see. We can see the purple tinge that also comes out. But that's why it's referred to as a black light. And so when you get these different when you get these different colored dyes, and you shine the light, it glows. Why? Because an electron is being absorbed and going from one pair of vibrational and electronic state to another, which then may fall a certain amount just by vibration, release a photon of a different energy, which is why things glow a different color than the light that's shown on them. So all these different glow by those light posters, that's what's going on, and this process is fluorescence. The spin allowed transition of a high energy electron down to a low energy electron by release of a photon. As you shine light on something, the electron keeps getting absorbing the light and keeps going up. But just like if I throw this pen up, once I've released it, it's going to fall back down again. There's nothing that holds an electron in a high energy level except the energy itself. Well, if that energy gets released, the electron falls, absorbs it again. And that, again, is what happens with these kinds of dyes. Of course, you turn the light off, no more energy is being put in. The electrons, once they fall, they stay, and so the glow stops. So this is not the process that happens with glow-in-the-dark tape. Have any of you ever been in theater? Which, this is the same reaction as I had yesterday, because when I say theater, some of you think, what, you mean the AMC down the street? No, I mean theater, as in, like, acting. The stage, where if you go on stage, they have these pieces of tape. When the lights go off, they glow so you don't trip or you know where to stand on your spots. Well, how does that tape glow once the light turns off? Because I haven't shown it very well in this diagram, but there might be a triplet state that might have a vibrational state that matches the singlet state. So again, so going from a singlet to a triplet is supposed to be one of these spin-forbidden transitions. But that's if no atoms were moving. That's if you just had electrons in the nuclei to deal with. But we don't. We have motion of them relative to each other, the nuclei, that is. And it turns out that if you end up with a situation where the vibrational energy of the level of a singlet is the same as the vibrational level of a triplet, you can have that spin flip occur, even though it's not supposed to. That leads to what's known as inter-system crossing. It is a spin-forbidden transition enabled due to vibrational states. If it slips into this triplet, it's a difficult process for the energy to be released and return back down to the singlet state. Difficult meaning takes time. This is called phosphorescence. So you shine light on an object. The energy is absorbed by the electrons that go into a high energy state. Once in that high energy state, it can, under the right conditions, do this spin flip that normally is not allowed to occur. Once it's in that state, if it wants to lose energy, it has to do some kind of process that's difficult for it to do. And so that takes time, which means you shine this glow-in-the-dark tape, it absorbs all that energy, you turn the light off, and it takes time for all those electrons to fall down again, and that's phosphorescence. So fluorescence and phosphorescence, the spin allowed and the spin forbidden transitions of high energy electrons back down to low energy. And they're both related to some of these glowing phenomena. Now, there's one last thing to tack on top of this. The fact that what we did, we're going to do today, is chemiluminescence, which is not necessarily in itself fluorescence or phosphorescence. It is this, that a chemical reaction all by itself causes an excited state to form that has the right energy and the vibrational pattern to then release light to let that chemical energy go. So you don't add light to get the electrons excited. It's a unique coincidence that the right molecular structure allows. That again, the reaction itself provides the energy to excite the electrons that then relax by releasing light.
So let me just read out what I wrote here. Chemiluminescence is a phenomenon caused by a chemical reaction in which the reaction itself causes the formation of an excited state intermediate that then can relax to the ground state radiatively, which means by releasing light. And so that's what's going on with your luminol. So what happened first is you started out with a derivative of phthalic acid. The same phthalic acid that's in the thalamide amine synthesis. Oops, which I was just about to write. Oh dear. So this is 3-aminophthalic acid, which you reacted with hydrazine and heat, which caused the formation of a double amide. Which is luminol itself. Part of what happens when luminol reacts has to do with that nitrogen-nitrogen single bond, and which is kind of in parallel situation to oxygen-oxygen single bonds, peroxides. Those are unusually reactive compared to a carbon-oxygen or oxygen-hydrogen bond, which is not that those aren't reactive, but not the same type of reactivity as a peroxide bond. So nitrogen-nitrogen bond, same type of thing. That's partly why hydrazine itself can be a hazardous chemical. Upon exposure to oxygen, decomposition of the luminol occurs.
According to the lab text that we're using for the procedure, this causes a triplet state to form. So it's a little bit backwards from the picture I showed you before. The triplet forms, it then crosses into a singlet state, which can then decompose. And that's the glow that you're going to see. And that is why your luminal glows. And as I told the other sections, just to make them laugh a little, because it is a little heavy on the technical here, you can now do what I did to some poor fellow once at a party that I went to. Because at this party, struck up a conversation with several people, one of whom was, let's say, slightly inebriated. And he made the mistake of asking, how does this glow stick work? And I told him. I told them exactly how it works. And then 15 minutes later when I was done, I'd never seen a person more confused and shocked in his life because he just didn't know what to say. It was kind of funny. Anyways, now as far as finishing off your experiment and making your luminol glow, I made a mistake, which we do have the time to fix, but I'm just warning you ahead of time. Because I didn't actually read the whole procedure through. I just remembered from the previous time we'd done it that there was a clear stopping point, which, because I was so eager to have you all start, because I was worried about the time factor, didn't realize that where I had you stopped was actually a bit short of where you could have stopped. So you do have a little bit of preparation that you need to do today, but then you will have time to make it glow, because the glow part doesn't take hardly any time at all. Now I'm going to put up the paragraph where it has that follow-up step that we failed to do. Once everybody's got that written down, or once you're already working on it, I'll then move over to the short paragraph that describes how to make it glow. I want to give you some heads up about that glowing part, though. Because there's a couple of components that go into it. There's the luminol itself, which you don't have to worry about measuring out the luminol. But there's the luminol itself that you're going to add in. You're going to have some pellets of potassium hydroxide, and then you're going to add in this compound, DMSO, which we haven't talked about it in so long. You might not remember it. Dimethyl sulfoxide, which I need to go look this up because I've now told the story three times, and I want to see if this is true or not, because DMSO, whether or not itself is toxic, supposedly is hazardous because it can easily absorb into the skin. And what I've been told is if you do something like rub a bit of garlic on someone and then smack down some DMSO, that they'll then taste the garlic because whatever compound it is, whatever sulfur compound in garlic it is that we taste, gets absorbed in, rides up the bloodstream, and well, you taste it. I've also heard, don't know for sure, but a variation of that, sort of a murder mystery type thing, take a little cyanide, put it on someone. Slap a little DMSO. Yeah. So again, I don't know if that's true, but the point being, the skin absorption part is true, so you've got to be careful a little bit with the DMSO, even if itself isn't hazardous. But you're going to be having this DMSO as a layer of liquid on top of that small layer of potassium hydroxide pellets. So the way it was described to me in the past is you want just barely enough DMSO that you just barely cover the pellets up. So too little, the stuff's not going to mix and you're not going to get a glow. Too much and you're going to dilute the glow that you get. So there's a fine balance point there. And then again, don't measure the luminol. Just take a small portion of your sample, try it first. No, you can't take these home to show your friends because these are not, this is not a nice, safe, contained glow stick. You could just go buy a glow stick and explain it to them. So once you're done, you might as well throw all your luminol in and try to make it glow really brightly. Now, the last bit of advice is that you have to shake these, agitate them to get them to glow. Don't just try to use your thumb because you're going to get DMSO all over you. Don't use just a gloved thumb even. Get an actual stopper so you can really shake the system up. We have the room in there that I'll leave the lights off in so that we can better see the glow. Even without the room being pitch dark, you'll see it glow. But you'll, of course, see it better in there. Once everybody has moved on to the last part of the lab, where you're doing the glowing, then I'll maybe turn some of the lights off in here. I already closed the blinds there. It'll be light enough here because of the windows that can't be shut that we'll still be able to operate. But by that point, most of you will be doing the glowing anyways. Now, we did full quantities last time, so we do full quantities this time. In the second paragraph I'm about to put up, there is a part there where it talks about saving some to do melting point. There's no melting point you need to do, no IR that you need to do. You'll know that it worked if it glowed. Questions? All right.